Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, this is Cindy F. Solomon with the Global Product Management Talk. Today is January 16th, 2012. For our American listeners, today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Our speaker, who is Mark Stiving, who is a PhD, he is discussing the impact of pricing on value. Also, Roger Coven has been a previous speaker. He's a product management expert, and he will be our co-host today. Hello, Roger and Mark.
Hello, Cindy.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Great. Again, this is Cindy F. Solomon from the San Francisco Bay Area. We are starting an hour later than we have in the past. We do have a survey up at our website at www.prodmgmttalk.com to find out when the best time is for people to participate. This is a Twitter talk. You can join us using the hashtag PRODMGMTTALK. There is more information at our website. This is a podcast where we discuss information on the subject matter with the speaker and also with our Twitter participants. So it is not a one-to-many discussion, but a many-to-many. And what's beautiful about Twitter is it lets many people discuss at once. We do have some questions prepared to stimulate conversation. Mark Stiving, who's a pricing expert, speaker, and author, is joining us today. He has a PhD in marketing from UC Berkeley and more than 15 years of experience helping companies implement value-based pricing strategies to increase profits. He's a speaker, coach, and consultant, and has worked with companies such as Cisco, Procter & Gamble, Grimes Aerospace, Rogers Corporation, as well as many small businesses and entrepreneurial ventures. He is the author of Impact Pricing, Your Blueprint for Driving Profits, and a lucky participant will win his book. So please tweet. The winner of the book will be chosen from amongst the top tweeters today. Also, Mark has a blog at pragmaticpricing.com. And you can also follow him at markstiving.com. Roger.
Sure. I'm Roger Coffin. I'm a product manager in Austin, Texas, based out of Austin, Texas. I currently work for a company called Dachis Group that works with companies to help improve their use of social media for business purposes. And I've participated in a few product management talks before, as well as been a co-host a few times. And I appreciate the opportunity to take part in this one as a co-host.
Great. Thank you. Mark, welcome.
Thank you.
So I want to say that we have M3 Boost, who is listening in from Western Australia. Also, Val Workman, who spoke last week, has joined us in the room with Marketing Now.
Let's start with a little story. When I was in college, we got to the very end of the class. One of my professors said to us, go ahead and grade yourself. Give yourself whatever grade you think you deserve in this class, and I'll decide if you actually get that grade or not. Fascinating concept. And if you think about it, pricing is exactly like that. You go out and develop your product, and you put as much into it as you possibly can. And when you get to the very end of the process, you get to grade it by putting a price on it. Depending on how well you did is how big of a price you get to put on it. And your customers are like my professor who decided whether or not you get that price or whether or not you get that grade. So pricing is really all about how do you capture the value that you as a product marketer or as a company are building into your product. And I love that analogy. I think it's a lot of fun.
Pricing a product is like giving a grade to your own assignment.
Yes.
Is how I...
Okay, excellent.
When I think about pricing, I think that there are three most important major topics that have to do with pricing. First and foremost is, as a person who sets a price, you have to understand you are charging for value. Always use value-based pricing, never cost-plus pricing. And the key reason is value-based pricing maximizes profit. Always. There's no other alternative to maximize profit. It is value-based pricing. We can talk in detail about what that means and how you measure value and all that, but let's move on to the second point for a second. The second issue is price segmentation. How do you charge different customers different prices? And then you have to ask yourself, is it fair to do that? And I can assure you that it is fair in most circumstances or in a lot of circumstances But then you have to decide under what circumstances it's not fair, and how do I keep from upsetting my customers? But yes, it is important to be able to charge different customers different pricing. And then the third most important thing to think about with pricing is portfolio price. Once you start creating a portfolio of products, you can price your substitutes, for example, good, better, best type pricing. And when you have complements, you get to do things like loss leaders or give discounts on certain products so that you can gain sales on other products. These are a nice, easy way to think of the three main and most important things to think about when you're thinking about pricing.
Val Workman initially had said, doesn't value depend on perspectives, which isn't fixed, and also giving a grade to a moving perception is a little harder.
Yeah, so let's talk about what value really is for a second. Value is how much your customer is willing to pay for the product. Think about a single customer for a second, and the decision that customer is making, they usually make two different decisions. The first decision is will I, meaning will I buy something in this product category, and the second decision is which one. Assuming I'm going to buy something in this product category, which one am I going to buy? The will I decision is really a budget decision. Is this in my budget? Is this something that I'm going to go out and spend money on? And pricing has some effect there, but not a very big effect. On the which one decision, which one am I going to buy, pricing is an exceedingly important variable. And in that which one decision, where value comes from depends on the next best alternative, whatever the price is of the next best alternative, and the product features that are different, and how much our customer values those product features. Now, that was a lot for you to tweet.
It is. Abbreviated it as value is how much a customer is willing to pay for product. A single customer makes two decisions. And so the two questions are, will I, can I afford it? And the second is, which one shall I buy? The value depends on next best alternative, pricing, and feature difference. So Marking Mel says, always use value-based pricing, not cost-plus pricing.
I agree completely.
That's the easy part, though. I think some of those three major issues that you highlighted, that's the first one, but those other two start to get a little bit more in-depth and become a little bit harder to know the answers to.
Yeah, and I just want to give a shout-out to our participants, Lisa, who's coming in from Mill Valley, California, whom I've met in person, and Erica Anderson, who is coming in from Salt Lake City, and also Val Workman, who I think is out by you in Austin.
Yes, he is.
Okay. And so he says, but don't we also have to consider our relative cost position as well when deciding price?
Costs are a fascinating problem when it comes to pricing. In general, costs don't matter. This is just a controversial statement, but in general, costs don't matter as to what price you should charge.
Okay, so costs don't matter.
Costs don't matter to the price. Now, fixed costs never matter to what price you should charge. Make that as a blanket statement. Fixed costs never matter to price.
Okay.
And you can understand that when you think to yourself, let's assume EA Sports for a second spends $1 million developing the next NCAA football video game. I'm willing to spend $50, $60 to buy it. If they spent $10 million developing it, does that mean I'm willing to spend $500 to buy it? No. My price and my willingness to pay has absolutely nothing to do with how much it cost them to make it. The only thing that their costs, their fixed costs matter, is whether or not they should ever get into that business.
That's what I call the intersection of cost and value-based pricing, where the cost-based pricing really is not pricing per se. It's that, well, should you have developed it in the first place? Should you make that decision to develop the product?
Yes.
If you're not going to be able to cover your costs with the value. If the value doesn't match the cost or exceed the cost, why are you developing the product in the first place?
That's exactly right. That's the fixed cost. Same is true with the variable cost side as well. So if it costs me $100 to build a product and the most my customers are willing to pay is $50, never should have built that product to be in the wrong market. However, if it costs me $100 to build a product, and someone's willing to pay $500 for it, charging what they're willing to pay makes a lot more money for me than just charging some cost-plus markup.
There's an opportunity, I hate to use the word cost here, but there's an opportunity cost to the company that's selling the product if they're thinking in cost-plus terms, because they may not be willing to, or they may be foregoing greater profit.
Absolutely right. I like to think of cost-plus as the way you set the floor of what you're willing to accept.
Set the floor of what you're willing to accept.
Yeah, especially if you're doing individual negotiations for products. So a lot of B2B products, a lot of capital equipment is individually negotiated. And especially on deals like that, you set your floor with a cost plus, this is the lowest I'm ever going to go, or I'll walk away from this deal. If you're doing a lot of products, if you're selling at a retail outlet or something like that, then cost plus as a floor makes less sense. And then we're going to talk about things like segmenting markets, and cost plus as a floor really says what's the lowest price I'm going to charge for a specific type of product or to a specific customer.
Put out the first question, which is, how do potential customers use price when deciding on which product to buy?
So we kind of went through that a little bit.
We did.
We talked about value.
Okay.
But let's do it again real quickly with an example.
All right.
Let's say that we're going to go buy a new car. And I'm thinking about buying a new Lexus. And I'm going to compare my new Lexus to a new BMW. Let's pretend that someone's the Lexus dealer, and that's the one that's doing the evaluation. So the Lexus dealer is thinking to himself, how much does that BMW actually cost? So that BMW might be a $70,000 car. And what features does that BMW have that my Lexus doesn't have? And what features does my Lexus have that that BMW doesn't have? And how much does that customer think each one of those features is worth? Now, it may be that the Lexus sells for less than the BMW because the BMW has more features. Or it may be that the Lexus sells for more than BMW because the Lexus has more features. But regardless, it has to do with the customers looking at two different products. They're saying Lexus or BMW. Let's say the BMW is $10,000 more. Is it worth $10,000? And that's how they're going to make that decision. What's the price difference between the two products? And is that price difference worth whatever difference in features that I'm going to get?
Kathy Liggett says, call me high maintenance and worry about a cheap car.
I'm laughing.
Lisa One says, pricing competitively is tricky since ultimately you don't want it to be about price. You do want it to be about features.
That's absolutely right. Now, you have to price competitively in the sense that I need to know what my competition is charging, and I need to know what my feature differentials are. However, when it comes to selling, you absolutely want to sell the features, sell what's better, sell the benefits of the features and why your product is better. And that's how you're going to justify the additional price that you get to charge. But you have to know your competitor's price.
So let me play maybe a little bit of devil's advocate here on the features point.
Yes.
Essentially, what that sounds to me like is saying that features really are the basis for determining the value of a product. Features relative to the competition how you determine the value of your product. Is that correct?
It is so close, and you should have said that given what I've been saying, but let me change what I've been saying slightly. What really matters is perceived differentiation. So differences in features is nice. What really matters is what your customers believe or know is true.
So first, let's talk about differentiation.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, mere differentiation isn't going to do it. There has to be something about that perceived difference that indicates value for the prospective customer. And so what is it about that perceived difference that creates that value? What is the nature of a valuable perceived differentiation?
Well, I don't think I could answer that question.
Well, let me put this forward. And some of us who have done these product management talks before and have talked to and have been involved with the pragmatic marketing organization, mm-hmm. there is a tendency to focus on prospect problems over features. In other words, not so much emphasizing the features of a product, but that the problems that it actually solves for prospective customers,
mm-hmm.
and that's really where the value is derived from solving urgent, compelling problems that prospective customers face.
So I would certainly agree that
what are your thoughts on that?
I would think that's the best way to go about it, or probably the most easily quantifiable. However, people buy Gucci bags not because it solves a problem, but because it makes them feel better. It gives them the ego or the reputation or the cachet that they're after. Now, maybe that's the problem they're trying to solve, but it's not what we think of when we think of solving a problem.
Right, so right. And a lot of those sort of consumer lifestyle type products, there isn't what we would normally think of as a compelling problem that they're solving. It's we could say that there is a problem that is maybe lifestyle related, but usually those don't seem very compelling.
Yeah.
Well, I think they're not compelling to us because we're focused on B2B, but in the consumer world, handling esteem problems are a big issue. The problems of esteem and status and those kinds of things. Indeed, they're lifestyle issues, but I don't want to say they're not problems, just not within our context.
I would certainly agree with that as well, Cindy. But let me, I love this concept of features versus benefits, or features versus problem solutions for a second. If you go to buy a new computer and you walk into Best Buy and the Best Buy guy says to you, so what are you going to use the computer for? And you say, well, I need it for email and I need to do some Excel spreadsheets and I need to surf the web. And he looks at you and he says, you need this computer because it's going to let you get all your email reliably and surf the web faster and the Excel spreadsheets will go smoothly. That didn't tell you anything, and I guarantee you that you're not going to buy that computer. And the reason is that you're an expert in that field, and you're making this which one decision, which is, I need to make a choice, and so I want to look at what are the product features of this product versus that product. When I spend my dollars, where am I getting a difference? I think that problem solution has a much, much bigger impact when you're talking about the will I decision. Am I going to spend money on a new Gucci bag? Am I going to spend money on a new car? Am I going to spend money on a new software application to solve a problem at work?
But even with pricing, isn't perhaps one of the major factors in whether you look at, I as a customer going into Best Buy, choose to look at features versus problem solutions, isn't that largely driven by trying to find something measurable and tangible? And the most measurable and tangible things that I can use as benchmarks are things like hard disk size, storage capacity, screen size, screen resolution, and things like that, whereas I was able to see quantifiably how much more productive I'm going to be using one computer over a different computer, how much time I'm going to save, how much more pleasant the experience is going to be. If those things were quantifiable, which unfortunately they're much more difficult to quantify,
right,
wouldn't those then become the criteria and benchmarks that I used to judge what was the fair price?
Yeah, I certainly think that if you could turn feature differences into productivity differences in a B2B world, then that would certainly be the way that you would want to value it. I was helping someone with the price of a motorboat engine the other day, and we were talking about that. And it really had to do in that case with how much more efficient is it, how much fuel are you going to save, and therefore how much money are you going to save based on fuel. That's a direct measurement, and that's exactly what you're talking about. Can I measure that exact productivity? In this case, it was fuel efficiency or dollars saved in fuel.
And can you feel confident that that alleged measurement is correct? You know,
yeah.
Somebody might tell you that, oh, you'll save this much per year on fuel, but you might not trust it as much as an MPG, a miles per gallon rating, or something that has some official stamp of approval on it.
Yes. And I think that's the key, at least in my mind, is that once you get into making the which one decision, which product am I going to buy, then you're working really hard to become an expert and you're studying the features and you're trying to figure out what to do. You know, right now at my company, it's the company I work for, Maxim, we are evaluating what pricing system to buy. And we're out doing that exact thing. And we're looking at product features and which features are most important. And what are we going to be able to get for that feature? And how much more would we spend for that? So it's pretty fascinating. Even on these huge investments, we still do the same thing.
So Mark, can you comment on what I call negative pricing? What I call negative pricing, and perhaps there's a much better term for it or even a standard term that I'm not aware of, is basing value on the amount that it costs not to use your product and instead to use an alternative to your product, whether that consumer or customer manually plugging through a solution to their problem or using a competitor's product. How much does it cost them not to use your product, basing your pricing on that? What are your thoughts on that idea?
So I think what you're saying, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is a total cost of ownership argument. When we get to the end, we say, what does it cost you to own this? What does it cost you to own the competitor's product? And what does it cost you not to own anything? And that cost is measured in terms of the dollars or time that you spend doing workaround or other things. And I think that's what you're really getting at, is this total cost of ownership argument. And it's a great argument, especially when you have the lowest total cost of ownership. It's one of those things that you want to lead with and say, look, here's where the real value is. Given that our total cost of ownership is much less, you really want to spend your money here and not do it or not buy the competitor's product. If we're talking about the same thing, it's absolutely the right way to go, assuming you're winning that total cost of ownership argument.
Now, that makes a lot of sense to me, and I think that is equivalent to where I was going. Then when I think about it, though, and I think about the spirit of what you mentioned earlier in the conversation, I wonder, what if it doesn't cost me anything in terms of price to not use your product, but it costs me a lot in terms of emotional pain? Then it may be worth it to me to purchase your product at a very high price, even though it costs me very little in terms of monetary cost to not use your product. So I'm just kind of playing, a little devil's advocate with what I just proposed.
Yeah, so in the world, in the B2B world, it is very common to do an economic value analysis, which is this total cost of ownership argument. And in the end, you put a dollar, how many dollars do you save, or how many more dollars of profit do you make? And it's a real dollars and cents type compensation and analysis. And in the consumer world, it's often less about, in fact, it's almost never about economic value, and it's almost always about some emotional decision. Even though people think it's logical, in the end, it's really emotional to some extent. And even in the B2B world, those emotions come into play. The question becomes, and I think this is what happens in almost every decision we make an emotional decision, and then we use logic to justify that decision. And so the question becomes, if you're solving a real emotional pain point, how well can you help someone justify solving that pain point in a B2B world? It's a combination of those two as to how much you're going to be able to charge for it.
P. Varanis asks, how does a customer's cost to build versus buy play into pricing of services? M3 Booth says, the total cost of ownership raises how much information the customer has on alternatives in your product. That information may not be perfect. And Val Workman says, going with a little-known brand, there is a lost cost.
I'm not sure what Val means on that comment.
Okay.
If I can mention on M3 Boost's comment, I think that's true with everything. Customers never have perfect information. And so we're back to that issue of what's the perceived differentiation. And as salespeople, we need to teach our salespeople how to sell value, because we need our perceived differentiation to be as high as possible. And that perceived differentiation comes from marketing, and it comes from our sales effort.
Meaning that value-based pricing is not just about having a very valuable product, but having one that is perceived as valuable due to that perceived differentiation.
Absolutely right.
And so you can't just focus all your efforts on creating the greatest product, the most valuable product in the fundamental sense. You also have to manage those perceptions as well and really dedicate some effort to marketing in order to generate those perceptions.
Well, isn't that what the brand is, the perceived value? Or I guess I'd have to be speaking to brand marketers who would say, yes, that's what brand is.
Well, so that's certainly... brand is certainly part of value. people buy Coke over RC Cola because of the brand, not because of the flavor. And so there's a perception there that they spent a lot of time building up. But you've heard the old saying, build a better mousetrap and they'll beat a path to your door. But that isn't true, especially in today's world with so many alternatives and so many options. I will bet you tons and tons of better products don't see the light of day or don't become successful because they weren't well marketed or they weren't properly sold. And so value comes from, perceived value comes from marketing and sales. The true value comes from the product and the product features, but people don't buy the true value. They buy the perceived value.
Could we skip to Q4, which is about, is it fair to charge different people different prices? If so, when?
Go ahead. I love that. So the answer is yes.
I just posted Q4, is it fair to charge different people different prices? And if so, when?
So the answer is certainly yes. And the reason we know it's yes is we see examples all around us. Sit in an airplane, and how many people in coach paid the same price for that flight? When you go to the movie theater, students pay less than you and I do for sitting at the movie, or the matinee costs less. So they're charging different prices. When someone in front of me at the grocery store is using a coupon to buy the same thing I'm buying, they're paying a lower price. So there are many examples of where people pay less. Where some people pay less than other people. And this is called price segmentation. When we think it's fair is when the rules are known and everybody has a fair chance to play by those rules. When the rules are changed or they're unknown, then people tend to think it's unfair. So, for example, we all think it's fair that movie theaters charge less to students. But would you think it's fair when you go up to the counter and someone looks at you and says, oh, you look rich, I'm going to charge you $15, and the next guy I'm only going to charge $10 to because they didn't look so wealthy. That just doesn't feel right because there isn't a set of rules that we're following. And as long as we have these set of rules that everybody knows and plays by, it seems relatively fair. If you think about when we think pricing is unfair, it's almost always when prices change. Think about Netflix. When Netflix raised their prices, people thought it was unfair. You think about grocery stores or convenience stores gouging for water during natural catastrophes. People think that's unfair. It's almost always because prices change upwards and rarely because we've decided that we're going to charge different people different prices.
That's right. So Haken Killick says Amazon is a great example. It tracks your buying behavior and charges differently for the same product. I didn't know it did that. Welcome Tech Zen PDM, who says that brand and value are symbiotic. Better products deliver better value, which in turn builds brand value. So he was responding to what we were discussing earlier.
Absolutely.
Val Workman says, a million flies doesn't make it right, but different people are paying different prices. And Haken Killick asks, when does price segmentation become price discrimination? That's a great point.
So it turns out that price segmentation and price discrimination are the same thing. Price discrimination is a common phrase used in academia, and when we do it in the business world, we call it price segmentation instead. There are many ways to do price segmentation. And so don't think that it's unfair for a second, because what we're trying to do is we're trying to charge a price that we think is fair to people who are willing to pay more, and yet people who are only willing to pay less, we're trying to find ways to get a lower price to them so that they're willing and able to buy anyway. So think about it for a second. Think about price segmentation as I charge a high price for a product. So I'm charging, I'm not sure what the price is nowadays. I think it's $10.50 to get into the movie theater. That's the price to go. Now, there are some people that can't afford that, but we'd still like to be able to sell to them. And so let's sell to them if they show us a student ID. Or let's sell to them if they're willing to come at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Or let's sell to them if they're willing to dig through the newspaper and find a coupon. So these are all ways where we find ways where we have the ability to get lower prices to people who tend to be less willing to pay, without having to lower our price to people who are willing to pay more. Price segmentation, with one exception that we're going to talk about in a second, price segmentation is almost always I charge a high price and give discounts to people who earn discounts for whatever reason.
So it's almost you're maintaining the value.
Exactly. You are maintaining the value. And you have to prove to me, Mr. Customer, that you deserve a discount. Can I take a shot at Hakan Kilik's question here?
Please.
So he tweets, think the problem is people don't like segmentation variables. Low supply means high price, but does gender. That last three words, but does gender, boy, that just cuts at the heart of the matter. We oftentimes want to charge different prices to people that we can identify in ways. So, for example, we can identify elderly people, and elderly people we usually give discounts to, and students who are really young we usually give discounts to because they tend to be able to pay less. But do you want to charge different prices to different genders, or do you want to charge different prices to different races or to different religions? And there are these variables out there that are just so sensitive that you really want to try to avoid that, because that will not be seen as fair unless there's some really good justification for it. For example, I know that young men pay a lot higher insurance rates than young women do, but that's because young men are much worse drivers and there's a justification for it. I know that women's haircuts are a lot more expensive than men's haircuts, and I can't really tell you why, other than I think women care more about the way their hair look than men do, and so they have a higher willingness to pay. And it's not clear why women aren't upset about that, but they seem to accept it. I guess my advice, though, for everybody is, unless you're really confident and comfortable, I would not charge different prices to different genders, races, or religions.
Okay, I'm calling it a rule of thumb.
Mm-hmm.
So Kelly Burrows, welcome. Kelly says, there are consumers who like to pay more as a statement of social status, which to them is part of the value. And Val Workman had said he appreciates your explanation on price segmentation. It makes sense.
Thank you, Val.
M3 Booth says, how much is the ability to differentiate in prices due to pricing power? Consumers may have little alternatives. Hakan Kilik had asked about, what about different genders? It's a sensitive issue. Mark said, don't charge different prices to different genders, races, or religions. And used as an example that women are willing to pay more for haircuts than men. Hakan says, because women's haircuts take longer. And I saw that you said the fairness of price discrimination depends on the fairness of the rules used to discriminate. Wow, good point.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I see so many different rules that people use to price discriminate with. And truthfully, everybody should be sitting around saying to themselves, how can I charge different customers different prices? And there's so many different examples. As you start watching what happens in the world, you'll see examples and you say, oh, I can probably do something like that, or maybe that's something I want to take advantage of. And it's usually in the form of, why do people get a discount? For example, here in the Bay Area, you can drive up to Lake Tahoe to go skiing. But if you buy your tickets while you're still here in the Bay Area, you can get discounts at Safeway. But you can't do that at the Safeway up in Lake Tahoe. And so that's just a method that says, look, some people who are more price sensitive are going to think ahead, and they're going to plan their trip and try to find the best prices, and we want them to go to our ski shop, so therefore we're going to offer these discounted tickets. But once you're up in Tahoe, we don't want it to be easy to get these tickets.
Right. TechZen PDM says, this example is a little different as underwriting plays an important part of this pricing managing risks.
We've been talking about the auto insurance one?
Yes. That's what he's responding to. Yep, the auto insurance. And M3 Booth says, women haven't experienced cheaper haircuts, so not as clearly aware of the price differential. Unofficial cartel and haircuts. And Hakan says, I'm giving all credit for the haircut comment to PV Ronis. Val Workman says, or is it about what you can get away with?
He's going back to that fairness question.
So I tend not to think of it as what I can get away with, but because I really do think of this, think of price discrimination as a very Marxist behavior for a second. We're taking from the rich and we're giving to the poor. If we charge the rich more and then we offer discounts to the poor, we're helping out the poor. Isn't that a good thing?
Okay.
So can we jump to the third topic?
Please. Please.
And the reason I want to jump to the third topic is because it is very tightly, half of it is very tightly related to segmentation. The third topic is pricing a product portfolio. And in truth, if you do not have a product portfolio, you should be creating one. If we talk about price segmentation for a second, what segmentation was all about was we want to be able to get people who are willing to pay more, and make it so that people who are only willing to pay less still have the ability to buy our products. We can do that by building good, better, best type products. And the good product is this product that we've priced as low as we can, the lowest price that we're willing to take, essentially, because we want these customers. And then the better product, we're making a higher margin on it, and so we charge a higher price, make sure that whatever extra cost it does for us to make it, we're charging much more than that to sell it for. And then the best product, we usually charge some really nice exorbitant price. And now what you've done is you've figured out a way for people who are very price insensitive are going to buy your best product. People who are very price sensitive are going to buy your good product. And people who are uncertain about what they really want are going to buy the better product.
See, we want to figure out a way for people who are price insensitive to buy the best, people who are price sensitive to buy the good product, and people who are price unaware.
Not price unaware, but people who are uncertain. So I bought a new iPad, and it was my first iPad. I got it, 4 months ago now, something like that. And when I was trying to decide which iPad to buy, as you know, Apple comes out in 3 different sizes. But how do you know how big of a memory you need when you've never had an iPad before? So the question is, if I were very well off, I would have just bought the most expensive one and not worried about it. And if I were barely scrimping and able to buy an iPad, I would have bought the least expensive one. But I wasn't either of those two. What I was uncertain. I had no idea what to get. And so I got the middle one.
So if price is no option, you buy the most expensive. If price is an issue, you buy the cheapest.
Usually, yes.
Price point uncertain, buy middle. Ah, so there's your case for small, medium, and large.
Exactly. Good, better, best.
So this good, better, best is based on, again, based on value, correct, Mark? It's not based on the production cost of those different options in the portfolio.
That is absolutely correct. One of the first times I realized that, this was the early 80s. And you may recall Intel had their 8486, and you could get it with a coprocessor and without a coprocessor. And what was funny was the version without a coprocessor cost less, of course. The price was lower. But it turns out it cost them more to make the version without the coprocessor, because they went in, after they built all these chips with the coprocessor in them, they went in with a laser and cut the links to the coprocessor so that they could sell a product that was less expensive. So it cost them more to make an 8480.
Yeah, I've heard that sort of thing happens a lot in the semiconductor business, where they'll even take some of the higher rated chips and they'll purposely calibrate them or sort of downgrade them to a lower speed rating and sell them at a lower price.
Absolutely. And what you're doing is you're trying to find customers who don't need the greatest, latest and greatest features. They're willing to settle for less and you charge them less.
Haken says his product manager friend at P&G did portfolio pricing. The premium product had an orange package, 0.3 cents more, but no other difference.
Yes. And some people will buy the orange package.
Right.
Why do people gravitate to cost-based pricing?
Oh, yes.
Or cost-plus, let's say cost-plus pricing.
Is it easier to do? Or is it because you can quantify it easily? You can analyze it on Excel easily.
Yes, it's an easy formula.
I think there may be a consistent theme here, a parallel theme here. As a consumer going into Best Buy, when I'm doing my product and pricing comparisons, I'm looking at features because they're tangible and easy to quantify and easy to benchmark. Similarly, if I'm a product manager deciding how to price my product, it's tempting to go the easy route and find the basis and the factors that are easy to quantify.
People are agreeing it's easier.
So certainly it's easier, and that's a great reason why people use cost-plus pricing. There are two other reasons which are really important. One is that if you're doing cost plus pricing, you're pretty sure you're making a profit. And if you do cost plus pricing at the lowest margin you're willing to accept, then you know you're being as price competitive as you possibly can be. It assures that you're making some money and you're being the most competitive. The other thing that cost plus pricing does, and one of the things I love about my competitors using cost plus pricing, is I can tell what prices my competitors are going to charge based on the way they behaved in the past. And so as costs move, I know what's going to happen to my competitors' prices. Now, it's actually kind of interesting. If you think about my favorite example of cost plus pricing are gas stations. When we see an announcement in the news that the price of oil goes up, the price of gas goes up the same day. And that implies to us that they're doing this cost plus pricing. But what's funny is when you see the announcement that says the price of oil came down, the price of gas doesn't come down that quickly. And the key reason is what drove prices up was everybody implicitly colluding, saying, hey, we want to charge a higher price. Implicitly, not explicitly. And what brings the prices down is slowly competition and people undercutting each other a penny at a time brings those prices back down to the standard margin.
M3 Boots had said, ask a cost-plus approach person, how much is plus? What size is the margin? That can be confusing. The first reason that cost-plus pricing guarantees profit at the lowest margin possible, but I didn't catch your second reason about cost-plus pricing.
It makes the marketplace stable. So we think about the gas station pricing. If my competitors and I are all using cost-plus pricing, then we all are going to be at about the same levels of prices.
Got it.
I enjoyed the gas station example that you gave, Mark, because many years ago, I used that, a very similar example, where there was a 5 cent a gallon gas tax increase announced in Texas, and immediately all of the gas station prices went up exactly 5 cents. And I predicted to my coworkers at the time that, you know what, this should probably, from a supply and demand perspective, that gas tax should probably actually be shared across the gas stations, the producers of the gas, as well as the consumers. And so it really, the fair market price should actually probably go up by maybe 3 cents instead of five. Well, sure enough, all of the prices started coming back down within days.
Yes, and that would be the competitors bringing the price back down.
I'm delighted that we had a lot of participation today. Thank you so much for joining us. It went far too quickly, Mark. Next week, Marketing Mel is speaking on promoting yourself as a product and creating a brand for yourself. Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Cindy, I would be thrilled. I had a lot of fun doing this. Thrilled to do it again.
Okay, great. And Roger, it's always great to have you.
Always good to join and honored to be able to join you as a co-host.
Great.
I really appreciate Mark having spoken today.
Thank you. You had great questions. It was a really good conversation, Roger, so thank you so much.
Okay, so have a great week. Thank you. Thank you, Roger.
Thanks, Cindy. Thanks, Roger.
Thank you.
Bye.
Good night.